right.
Be seated. Our next case is 11-1089, Angel Horvath et al. Versus David Ish et al. For the appellants, Mr. Fitzgerald.
Good morning, Your Honors. Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. I'm Tim Fitzgerald. I'm here on behalf of the appellants, David Ish and his parents, who have been sued on account of an accident that occurred back on March 6, 2007, as a result of a collision that occurred between David Ish, who was a 14-year-old high school student at the time, who was snowboarding down an intermediate level slope at the Boston Mills Ski Resort up in Summit County, Ohio, and the plaintiff in this case, Angel Horvath. The legal issue that's before the court this morning is what is the standard that will govern the cause of action that might occur as a result of a collision on a ski slope in Ohio? Is that standard set forth in the precedent of this court that holds that when an individual engages in a recreational or sporting activity, that there is no liability unless there is reckless or intentional conduct by the tortfeasor? Or is that standard set forth within a statute, which is known as the Ohio Ski Resort Statute, found in Revised Code Chapter 4169, and whether or not the standard that is set forth therein establishes either a strict liability or a negligence per se liability? The issues are before the court this morning, asking that the court reverse the decision of the Ninth District Court of Appeals, which had overturned the summary judgment ruling of the trial court that had applied the common law standard, that, in other words, the standard that this court had set forth in its precedent to determine that there was no liability. The reasons that the issues seek reversal in this case are three. The first is that, as a matter of law, the collision between skiers on a slope in Ohio is an inherent risk that is assumed by all skiers. And when I mention skiers, I mean snowboarders as well, because under the law in Ohio, the legislature has defined a skier to include a snowboarder, a person using a toboggan. So a skier can be used interchangeably.
So that would be just the general common law on assumption of risk.
That is correct, Justice Byford, and it would be express assumption of the risk. And that is the second issue that is before the court, and that is whether or not the statute that's applicable here, 4169.08, creates some other standard, some other legal duty that would govern a collision on a ski slope such as this.
So you want us to find that the common law trumps the statutory law?
Not necessarily trumps it, but that the standard that has been articulated by this court is compatible with, and in fact the legislature did not overrule or in any way disturb the precedent of this court.
That would work for me in a lot of other cases.
I hope it works in this case, Your Honor. The final issue is just that, whether or not there is a meeting of the burden to establish recklessness or intentional conduct by David Ish that was in play at the time of the collision in this case.
Mr. Fitzgerald, didn't the Ninth District send it back to the trial court to determine the interplay between the common law and 4109? There seems to be, of course, your opponents arguing that this case isn't even in front of us because the shouldn't be in front of us because the Ninth District did not establish a negligence per se rule. And when you look at their last two paragraphs, they seem to say, send this back to the trial court to decide what the appropriate interplay was and whether there was recklessness on the part of David Ish.
There is a little bit of inconsistency is the way I would put it, Justice McGee-Brown. I think what the court did was raise that issue, remand it, but in the very last paragraph of the opinion, does go on and says that applying a recklessness standard, they found that there was at least an issue of fact as to whether or not David Ish engaged in reckless conduct.
But they said without deciding it, right?
The actual language of the Court of Appeals says that there is a genuine issue of fact as to recklessness. So what the Court of Appeals did was seem to leave open the question of the interplay, but then in the very last paragraph foreclosed the ability to pursue that that recklessness standard, at least at the summary judgment stage, by finding that there was, in fact, a genuine issue of fact as to recklessness. So that is why it is properly before the court here. There was a determination by the Court of Appeals that now forecloses the issue of whether recklessness, whether there's an issue of fact as to recklessness on remand.
So if we would determine that a recreational standard would exist as to the reckless or intentional conduct of a skier, we would simply affirm the ninth, the case will go back, and you'll have a trial as to whether the Mr. Ish was or was not reckless or engaged in intentional conduct.
No, we are asking the court to recognize that recklessness standard.
Well, if I understood your answer to Justice Brown's question, the Ninth District did recognize a recklessness standard.
They said that that if there was a recklessness standard that applied, a genuine issue of fact existed.
Right. And you want us to recognize that as well?
That standard, that is correct. And clarify that there is not this confusion as to whether or not there is an interplay with the statute and that common law standard. So it would clarify what the Court of Appeals said in terms of what would perhaps happen on remand, although it foreclosed the possibility of recklessness being an issue on remand, and to recognize that distinction or that the interplay between the statute and the common law should be consistent with each other.
Do you see this as a case of summary judgment or as a case of a trial on the issue of recklessness?
At this point in time, we would ask the court to reinstate the summary judgment on the basis that, despite what the Court of Appeals said in terms of the state of the record, in fact, there is no evidence in the case, admissible and competent evidence in the case, that would establish a recklessness standard. Keep in mind that when Eugene Horvath, who was a plaintiff in the case, testified in his deposition, on three separate occasions, he was asked, you know, what the complaint was about the way David Ish was skiing. And he specifically said on three separate occasions in his deposition that he saw nothing of concern to him up until the point in time when there was the collision. And the fact of the matter is that is the evidence that was properly before the trial court. That was what the trial court relied upon in deciding that there was no genuine issue of fact on the recklessness and why summary judgment should be reinstated here.
Well, there would be potentially factual questions when they're having in this recreational activity. Collisions generally occur because people cross paths and someone from behind hits someone in front of them.
And that is a risk.
And so. Whether one observed a snowboarder in the past and their activities, the victim here might be in a poor position to know what the snowboarder did that caused this crash.
In fact, that is exactly what the state of the record is, Your Honor. Ms. Horvath did testify that she did not see Mr. Ish at any point in time before the collision. The only individuals who did see the collision in addition to David Ish, would be Mrs. Horvath's now husband, Eugene Horvath. At the time, I think he was just her boyfriend, and Tyler Ish. And there is some dispute between the witnesses as to how the mechanics of the actual collision occurred, who collided with whom, which side did the individual come from. Those all deal with the issue of proximate cause, who caused the accident. What we're dealing with in this case is, what is the duty? Is there a duty of a legal duty that can be imposed upon one or the other?
Do you think there is a duty for an uphill skier to avoid collision with a downhill skier?
There is a duty to for both sides, both the downhill skier uphill skier to observe their surroundings. But the issue is not whether
a downhill skier couldn't avoid a collision with an uphill skier, could it? Generally, if you're looking down the hill and moving toward the bottom, you're not looking behind you. That's why common sense would suggest the uphill skier has a duty to avoid collision. But you don't see that.
How I'd answer that question is that duty is absolved by the assumption of the risk doctrine, which is that regardless of who is uphill,
every skier on every ski slope assumes a risk of injury.
That is correct. That is what the General Assembly in Ohio has said. That is what the courts across the country that we have cited in our brief have said. And in fact, Ms. Horvath in her deposition acknowledged that there was that risk, said that in fact a collision between skiers is an inherent risk that she acknowledged.
Well, and then it's your view that there, when a collision occurs, there is no liability for an uphill skier or any skier. Do you see it with an intentional act?
That is the exception. And when we acknowledge that under either the common law or even under the statute, that exception should still be observed, as is true for any sporting or recreational activity.
But you don't see it with reckless activity.
Yes, I do. I will recognize that there is that standard would apply. Both recklessness, it's either recklessness or intentional conduct.
Okay, intoxicated uphill skier who recklessly meanders down the hill and collides has responsibility.
Yes.
Okay.
At least an issue could be raised.
But you're saying if you have that standard of reckless here, that the deposition evidence taken supports the summary judgment because there is no evidence that there was any degree of recklessness by David Ish.
That is correct, Chief Justice O'Connor. That is what the trial court found. And we would submit that is the absolute state of the record at the time of summary judgment in terms of what Mr. Ish had Mr. Horvath had testified during his deposition, that they were consistent in the fact that there was nothing about the way David Ish was snowboarding prior to the collision that would rise to the level of a recklessness standard.
What caused the collision then? What's the theory of the collision?
Inattention by either or both of them, which would be a negligence standard. Either one or both of them were negligent. And
whereas excessive speed might be reckless or hot-dogging or whatever.
There could be innumerable facts that could have come into play that one would have expected Mr. Horvath to have testified during his deposition.
Well, counsel, I thought that the status of the law and also even maybe what you get when you buy a ticket to ski tells you that you're required to ski in control, so stay on a slope that is equivalent with your abilities, and part of skiing in control is being able to control yourself to avoid people who are below you as you go down the slope. I thought that was the duty on every skier and snowboarder.
That would be true for a negligence standard. That is the ground.
The recreational activity part of the statute really is relating more to the fact that you can fall and break your leg and crack into a tree. You can do a lot of things that will hurt you badly in skiing. But does it really immunize
negligent conduct? Yes,
negligent conduct.
It does. Under all Marchetti versus Kalish, the Thompson versus McNeil case, the Gentry versus Craycraft case, or the three cases from the Supreme Court here that have all recognized that there may be negligence. And if you take the case of the young girl playing kick the can in the Marchetti case, or the golfer in the Thompson case, or the young child nailing the hammer or nailing the the board in the Gentry case, this court has all in all three of those cases.
Were there statutes involved in those?
No, no, there were not. But
so this
to answer, this
is
unique,
different from that.
Somewhat different in the sense that what is contained within the statutes are not characterized as duties. In fact, they're characterized as responsibilities. And in fact, the language of the statutes are ambiguous because of the fact that the way they're described as to the ski resort's obligations to the skier and a skier's obligation, the ski resort's obligations are characterized as legal responsibilities. As to the skier, it just says responsibilities. Now, admittedly, the ski statute is designed to try to increase the safety on ski slopes. And whether a skier is negligent is you know, something that is intended to be avoided by enactment of the statute. But you don't get to the question of legal liability unless there can be a finding of recklessness or intentional conduct. And so it is for that reason that we would submit that there should be, in fact, summary judgment in this case. We would ask that the court reinstate the summary judgment that
so
the trial
are you
court
saying that it's an inherent risk, that negligent conduct on the slopes is an inherent risk of the activity?
That a collision that may be the result of negligent conduct on the slopes is an inherent risk of skiing.
Okay.
Courts across the country have recognized that. And we would ask the court to do that as well.
Okay. Has any other state Supreme Court weighed in on this question, to your knowledge? Colorado, Utah?
I'm not aware of any state Supreme Court cases that have weighed in it. There are a number, and we've cited them in our brief, Court of Appeals opinions that have dealt with collisions that occurred and where there have been statutes involved. And the courts have all said that there is no negligent per se or strict liability, that it is the recreational or sporting activity statute or common law that applies in those circumstances.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Flowers.
Madam Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is Paul Flowers. I represent the plaintiff appellee in this case, Angel Horvath, who managed to find room in the courthouse today. I thought I'd start off with Justice McGee Brown's question about what did the Ninth District do and why are we here? And my answer to that is that it's apparent to me that the Ninth District just wrote a very narrow decision. And all they said, this is the majority, was that there's evidence of recklessness here. And for that reason alone, summary judgment was improperly granted. The key issue that the trial court overlooked, and Judge Unruh wrote a very detailed opinion, but what isn't in there is the testimony that when David Ish collided into my client from behind, he was looking backwards. He was not looking forward. His head was turned, looking back to the terrain park. And that's something you can do very easily on a snowboard. Hard to do while skiing, easy to do on a snowboard. Anybody who's cutting across a slope, particularly a gentle slope like Buttermilk Hill, who isn't looking where they're going, is going to collide with somebody or something. In this case, it was someone. That's why it's reckless, and that's the difference. And all we had here was just the Ninth District saying, you got recklessness, we're sending it back. You need to sort through the standards that are going to be applied because we're not going to decide that for the first time on appeal. And that's just sound judicial restraint.
And Mr. Flowers, where was the that statement found? Was it in a deposition? Whose deposition, please?
It's Eugene Horvath's testimony. I believe it's in his deposition, but I know it's in his affidavit. And there's no argument here that he contradicted himself. But he's the only witness for the plaintiff because Angel's downhill. She can't see what's going on. He's behind her, I think he said 70 feet or so. It happens very quickly, but he does say that Mr. Ish is turned backwards when he collides into him, and that it makes perfect sense. I mean,
isn't there an issue of some loud noise or distraction that made him look in that direction?
Yeah, but it was more like.
Isn't that what the judge also looked at and said? Well, you know, maybe he needed to look there to be sure there was no danger from there, and that's when he collided. So the judge looked at that evidence and said, that may be negligence. He should have maybe kept looking forward and not tried to see what the noise was about, but he looked sideways, which is a reasonable thing to do.
Well, it's evident to me he was looking back to where his friends were in the raucous from the terrain park, not that there was any legitimate reason for him to look back. I mean, there's nothing back there that's going to threaten him.
Loud noise. That's what the testimony was in the record.
You know, and maybe that's something a jury could be talked into, you know, this idea that he had to look back. There was a good reason for him not to be looking where he was going. But that's just not the sort of thing we can resolve on summary judgment. That's a classic jury issue.
Do you maintain that, are you asserting today that recklessness is the standard, not negligence?
No. I'm glad you asked that because we talked a lot about recklessness. We still believe very firmly that there is a standard of negligence here.
Okay, so we do have an issue to decide.
You could.
I mean, if you're going to go back and claim negligence, mm-hmm. and the recreational statute seems to be trumping this because there is a common law recreational out there, mm-hmm. and this would be the only sport that would be outside of that protection, we have an issue. So why would we send it back for you to go back and claim negligence? I mean, if you were going to go back and represent to us, you're only going to claim recklessness, we might agree with you that that's the only issue we have to send it back for. But now you're telling us that's not what you want.
Correct.
Correct? So we do to address the negligence issue then and look at the interplay of statute because that's what you're going to claim when you go back.
Sure. I mean, if this court wants to wade into that, I'm all for it because I think I'm right. It's just odd to me that no court has decided this yet. I mean, the trial court hasn't, the Court of Appeals has, and we generally don't argue these things for the first time in the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. But that said, you know, we have a statute here. You're absolutely correct. And when I heard the idea come up that perhaps the common law trumps the statute, I mean, that was music to my ears. I'm going to be up here arguing an intentional tort case in a couple of months, and I'd love to hear that the common law still prevails over the statute. But that's not how it works in Ohio. We have a statute that imposes a duty that's under, right, quarter right, 4169.09.08C2, and I'll read it, imposes a duty on all skiers and snowboarders to refrain from acting in a manner that may cause or contribute to the injury of another person, to refrain from causing collision with any person or object while skiing.
Is that a strict liability clause?
I think it presumes carelessness, I'd have to say.
It doesn't really say, does it? It's kind of...
Yeah, it would... You give it to a jury in an instruction, they'd have to decide whether or not he had an opportunity to avoid the accident. Did he cause that? If he did, he's liable. That's the way I would see it working. And then we have a separate section, this is in .09, that imposes liability for a violation of a duty under this chapter. So it's really that simple. I mean, if a jury finds that Mr. Ish violated this duty, the C2 duty, there is liability. That's it.
Is that negligence per se, as it's been characterized, yeah. or is it that this just statutorily defines what would have otherwise been common law negligence on a ski slope? It would be about the same thing, wouldn't it,
right.
that you've got to be aware of skiers below you, and if you're skiing faster than they are, you have to assume that they're going to turn from time to time and be able to turn when they do and avoid them.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't see the reason to go into negligence per se because we have a statute that imposes liability. I mean,
so for your client to prevail, they would have to prove negligence, and the negligence. Instead of looking to a bunch of cases, you can look to the statute, and that says this is what amounts to negligent conduct. So you still have to to prove that. The statute doesn't say if you hit a skier below you, you are per se negligent.
No.
That would be negligence per se, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's – I mean, I guess the way I look at it is it's like the products liability law used to be in Ohio. You had a statute, and you could prove your claim under that. You also had the common law. You could prove your claim under that. The legislature then clarified that the statute prevails, so now we just have the statute. Here, there's nothing in the Skiing Act that says that the common law has been overridden. So Ms. Horvath can pursue either her statutory claim, which does not require recklessness, or she can pursue her common law claim, which might require recklessness if collisions with other skiers is an inherent risk of skiing.
Well, so then the inherent risk only survives under a common law cause of action. Is that
right.
what you're saying? There is no, and under the statutory scheme, there is no assumption of the risk.
Right. The General Assembly could have put that in there. It's not in there.
Unless you read reckless into the standard you know, you have the duty to, however that was worded, and you attribute that to mean to violate that would require a reckless, although it's not stated, but nothing is stated in that statute as far as the whether it's negligence or reckless or intentional.
Right, and that's up to the General Assembly. I mean, we're not...
They didn't put anything in there.
Well, I mean, it says you cannot cause or contribute to the injury of another person. All right, so cause implies it's your fault, and negligence would be the obvious standard there. If you have a situation, two skiers, they're at the same level, so one's not in front of the other, they're heading to a trail opening, maybe in collide, you know, there's no liability there. They're both on equal planes. But it absolutely is the rule of the slopes that the downhill skier has the right of way. And it's just like Justice O'Donnell said. I mean, the uphill skier is the only one who can perceive the danger and take evasive action. So the duty is on him or her.
But that presupposes then that statute eclipses the common law recklessness standard. Is that your view?
Yes.
That's what you're arguing to us. There is no more.
I must admit the statute prevails over the common law.
Yeah. That's your view.
Fortunately, no one's recording this, right? But I just see this case, the first time I looked at it, it's just so much simpler if you go with the statute, you know, because she's got a claim. If she can convince a jury that he caused her injuries, that's game, set, and match. That's what the statute says. And you know, the dissent in the Court of Appeals opinion, I mean, I really respect Judge Carr, but she's working very hard to get a result that's just not in the terms of that statute.
But that statute, to read it that way, is just so contrary to the activity and the common law and the history of the sport of skiing, the recreational sport of skiing.
Right.
It just is just so diametrically opposed to what actually happens.
Well, it needs to be viewed properly. Skiing is a dangerous sport. You can crash into trees. You can catch a ski on a rut. There's all sorts of things that can happen. But one of the risks you don't assume and agree to is for an out-of-control skier to injure you.
An out-of-control skier is not, in my mind, a negligent skier. An out-of-control is a reckless skier. So I think that there's a difference.
I don't think I disagree with you. I think that if you're not looking where you're going, you're being reckless. And I've skied my whole life, and I can tell you, I mean, it's taking your own safety in your own hands as right. well as everybody else if you're going to turn backwards and look to where your buddies are.
And I've skied also. I've skied also, and I've been a hazard for every skier ahead of me because I'm so bad and slow.
Oh, I don't believe that.
Oh, gosh, yes.
But, you know, just to – oh, I'm sorry. Just a couple.
Maybe the rules of skiing are unique, but if you're not looking where you're going at the moment, if that's recklessness, we'll talk about the ordinary automobile thing when you come up to a stop sign, and maybe you don't look and you go, that's not normally recklessness, that's normally negligence.
Right.
So what makes it more reckless or more, I guess, culpable? Mm-hmm. Maybe that's not the right term either. on the ski slope than on the highways.
Well, I would say I think the closer analogy is if you're on the highway proceeding forward, looking out your rear window. You know, some kid sees his friends in a car behind him, and he's looking backwards and plows into somebody. I think everybody in this courtroom would agree that that's reckless, and maybe even worse.
But you're supposed to be driving. If you're going forward, you can look in the rearview mirror for oncoming traffic, especially if you're going to pass. I mean, you have to divert your attention from going forward, you know, which is why driving is such serious business. You've
right.
got to be able to, you know, multitask while you're driving. So the analysis that Justice Cupp brings up here, I think, is quite relevant.
Oh, absolutely. And my response to it is that, you know, that's a jury issue. You know, if you have to look in your side view mirror because of a situation behind you, then absolutely. You know, a jury could find that to be a viable defense. I don't recall Mr. Ish saying in his deposition there was a good reason for him to be looking the other way. I think he denied he looked the other way. His version has Angel Horvath causing the collision, and his own brother, Tyler Ish, doesn't agree with that. So, you know, maybe he's got this defense. I haven't seen it. But that's something that should be resolved at a trial, not through affidavits and depositions and so forth.
So assuming the Ninth District did not create this negligence per se rule, which I don't see it from the opinion, doesn't this basically boil down to whether there is a genuine issue of material fact on the recklessness? Mm-hmm. Or I think it's a reckless standard if you look at the statute, but that's not really the issue before us. It was the issue of whether there was negligence per se.
Correct. Right. Yeah, that's the only way you can read that opinion, because they're very careful about how far they go, Judge Belfant's in her majority opinion. So I think if you read it closely, that's all you can say, is just that the court found some evidence of recklessness and sent it back. Mm-hmm. With that, we'd ask you to affirm the Ninth District. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Fitzgerald, you have used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just two quick points. If you look at the statute, the 4169.08C2, the way, and this is what Mr. Flowers read, to refrain from acting in a manner. In what manner? Mm-hmm. Negligent manner? Strict liability manner? Recklessness standard? And you don't know. And what we're asking for is not to trump the statute, but to interpret it in a manner that's consistent with the common law, recreational and sport activity doctrine. And I think the court can do that. And the way I suggest that is when Mr. Flower said that the statute does not negate the common law, it does. There is a specific provision in the statute where the legislature said we are going to trump the common law premises liability law for the ski operator, the ski area operator. They didn't do that with the recreational and sport activity doctrine. And that doctrine was in effect when the statute was put into place. So I think it can be construed consistent with the common law, not necessarily trump it.
Thank you. Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.